Hi, welcome to NSYNC, the podcast that explores the history and impact of some of your favorite music moments in TV and film. I'm your host, Rachel Brodsky.
And I've got a case of the Mondays.
In the post-pandemic age of quiet quitting, lazy girl jobs, and the general rejection of late-stage capitalism, the 1999 cult classic Office Space remains as relevant as ever.
Written and directed by Beavis and Butthead's Mike Judge, Office Space is a satirical black comedy about mid-level cubicle workers at a Texas-based tech company that is so beige, so corporate, and dull, it still serves as a stand-in for just about any desk job workplace.
Running counter to Office Space's drab setting is the film's frequent use of gangster rap, with classics like Ice Cube's Down for Whatever and Ghetto Boys' Still, and this episode's focus track, Damn It Feels Good to Be a Gangster.
It sure does. And joining us is music journalist Soumya Krishnamurthy, whose new book, Fashion Killa, How Hip-Hop Revolutionized High Fashion, is now out via Simon & Schuster.
So how did a film about white-collar corporate drudgery end up with a soundtrack populated almost entirely by gangster rap? What, if any, pushback did that decision receive? And how did Ghetto Boys feel about their songs being used to soundtrack workplace disillusionment?
Let's get into it on the latest episode of NSYNC.
Don't jump to conclusions.
Jumpstart your career at St. Clair's Health. Discover an amazing and rewarding workplace. St. Clair's in Denville, Dover, and Booton is now hiring RNs, LPNs, CT techs, social workers, and more. Join an award-winning network of community hospitals, receive a competitive salary, and experience a great place to work with supportive coworkers in a beautiful location. Check out the bonuses. Apply today at stclairs.com/careers. That's stclairs.com/careers.
St. Clair's Health. My community, my hospital, my commitment.
My commitment is helping my cardiac rehab patients so they can live an active and fulfilling life.
My commitment is to my patients' comfort and their confidence in me with their diagnostic scans.
My commitment is to truly care for each of our emergency patients. I see them when they are most vulnerable.
St. Clair's Health, around the corner, ahead of the curve.
Soumya, thank you so much for being here with us. Please, will you tell us a little bit about yourself and your work and your book?
Well, I too have a case of the Monday, so I feel very much at home with Peter and the good folks of Inatech. It's funny. So for me, this movie came out when I was a kid. So this idea of working in an office and the drudgery of being in a cubicle was many, many decades away. But I remember watching this and it was almost this cautionary tale. So I knew when I grew up, I just did not want to work in an office. I could not get Lumberg's face out of my mind with the TPS reports and all of just the corporate red tape and the politics and bureaucracy. So as a kid, what should have been a dark comedy was really a cautionary example
for
me. It was a horror movie. And for the kids out there, when you grow up, it's the real life. It's a true crime story. I've been a music journalist for over a decade, and Fashion Killa is my first book. And like a lot of writers, I really wanted to create a life that I didn't have to work in an office. So most of this book was written on my couch over the last 3 years during COVID. And it features really just kind of a who's who of the hip hop and fashion world, with interviews from everybody from Dapper Dan and Pusha T to ASAP Rocky. And this book really is a 50-year retrospective of hip hop. But in so many ways, for me as a journalist, it's my first book. So it's kind of another brick in this career that I've built, where I can, as much as possible, stay away from being in a cubicle.
I feel that in my bones.
This is it. This is an audio only medium, but for the listener out there, Rachel and I were just like quietly, emphatically nodding,
yeah.
As you were talking about never wanting to work in an office, parentheses again. So for season two of our show, we decided to do something a little bit different, which is that we let our guest pick the needle drop, and we put it to you that to ask you if you had a favorite needle drop, and you came right back with "Damn, it feels good to be a gangster" from Office Space. How or why did you choose this specific needle drop?
Office Space is one of my favorite movies of all time. Again, oh, wow. It's one of those movies where at any given moment you turn on like a Comedy Central and it's always on at some part, and you can just jump in and enjoy the movie. And as I said, when I was coming up as a kid, I didn't really understand so many of the nuances. But when you have done certain stints in offices, you see how much reality is baked into this script. And not a lot has changed. I know post-COVID, we have a lot of work from home and hybrid. But I think anyone who's in an office knows the politics, you know, just dealing with your coworkers, the fact that sometimes the only bright spot in your week is possibly getting birthday cake, hopefully it's somebody's birthday, and very little has changed. I think that's why this movie stands up. It was always funny to me, just that juxtaposition of these like dorky tech workers who find escapism in hip hop, and whether it's them sort of, you know, throwing caution to the wind and living their best independent lives, or beating up the copy machine that just causes them so much grief. The fact that their version of feeling in control and feeling powerful and strong comes from hip hop always was funny to me. And I think this movie is great. It really stands a test of time. Ron Livingston as the lead is awesome. There's a post Friends Jennifer Aniston, who does a great job in kind of a much more subdued comedic role. And I swear, I mean, anytime I'm in an office setting and somebody says something that's completely irrational and clearly busy work, all I can think of is TPS reports. And similarly, when I go to any of these sort of really like hokey restaurants where they have things like awesome blossoms, all I can think about is the poor employees who have to wear all that flair and have a smile on their face. And just, I tip my hat to them, because I know behind the scenes, they're probably going through a lot. They wish they could listen to this song on full blast.
And they're like the ones, the employees who like really do seem to love it. And then the employees like at these restaurants, and I think in corporate settings too, there are some like real rah-rah cheerleaders who are like, we're a family. And then there are others who are just like, please get me out of here. I had a boss once who would not really engage in the social setting, like the social scene within our workplace. And I really admired him for that. But the rest of the workplace, they sort of bristled at it. Like, you're not cooperating. You're not partying or just hanging with us. But he was, you know, he was on the right side of history. And I've completely then like we're still he and I are still friends, and I'm glad for him that he set his boundaries. But like I think I like how the movie explores like the weird stupid politics that exist, like regardless of like desk job or if you're like in a serving position. And it's like every line of work has these politics.
So wildly, this is concurrent with Friends. This is like in season 5 or so of Friends. So Jennifer Aniston is like one of the biggest stars on the planet right now, and she joins up this like $10 million. She's making like $1 million a week, so she's getting paid probably.
I think that probably didn't come till a little bit later.
It's like
in the latter. I'm like a Friends freak, so. It was like in the last.
I mean, this was 99, so maybe it's like the last
or like 98.
Yeah. And Friends was on from like 94 to 2004 or so.
It's like a solid 10 years. Yeah. And I think the last 3 years they were getting like $1 million per episode.
Well, I love how for like Jen Aniston, she's like slumming it, right? So
yeah, right.
The hair and makeup budget are nowhere near Rachel. The hair's not as shiny. She looks like a regular girl. And I could just see her reading the script and thinking they're not going to expect Jennifer Aniston to take a movie like this. Yeah. So the fact that I'm going to go kind of left and I'm not the lead, she's very much a supporting character. But to me, I really have a lot of respect for her as an actress, because she absolutely did not need to take that big pay cut. I'm sure the trailer was smaller, the craft services weren't as good as on Friends. You know, she really had to, you know, in many ways, just showcase her love for the craft. So I have a lot of respect for her. And I think she does an amazing job in this movie of just playing that very, the subtle, almost the, kind of like the straight man, right? This idea that she's the one who sees that Peter and his friends, like what they're really doing is not right. And if you don't like something, you should leave and stop complaining. And at the end of the day, you're really in control of your destiny. And I think she does a really good job playing that supplementary role.
Yeah, she's kind of the moral center.
She really is.
Mike Judge has been really great at these kind of subtle or not so subtle satires throughout his career. He started with Beavis and Butthead, co-created King of the Hill, and then
Silicon Valley.
This movie came right after Beavis and Butthead Do America. Then he did Extract and Idiocracy, which has gained like a cult following. And then he did, Silicon Valley for HBO. So he's always been a little bit ahead of his time in terms of the thing he's lampooning, right? He's like just a tiny bit clairvoyant. But a little bit about the movie in question, the movie of the week, which is Office Space. It's an interesting time capsule of the 90s and capitalism and masculinity. So it follows Peter, who works as an office drone for a software company in Austin, and he is henpecked by his girlfriend, and therefore, or maybe not exactly therefore, he's in love with the waitress at his local TGI Fridays analog, the grossly named Tchotchkes. And Peter is hypnotized into not giving a shit about his job. The hypnotist, played by Whose Line Is It Anyway alum Mike McShane, he has a heart attack and dies before he can snap Peter out of the trance. And Peter starts living his life the way it should be lived, like every day is his last, and he becomes the first king of quiet quitting. He and his two work friends, Samir Nagina Najjar and Michael Bolton, hashtag not that Michael Bolton, team up to get rich by implanting a computer virus that skims a couple cents off of every transaction that the software facilitates, which is the same scheme from another 90s masterpiece, Hackers.
Oh my God, Hackers.
But before they can pilfer the money from the company that undervalued them, they have to fight the real enemy, the office copy machine.
I thought it was the printer. Is it a printer and copy machine, like combination?
I think so. The office printer, the gray, it has that like gray 90s brushed texture that I just assumed was a copy machine.
I want to say real quick that I read this somewhere and I thought it was such an amazing point that like this whole movie takes place pre-email, because they're getting memos, not emails, and pre-internet, or at least pre, like, every office has internet, and it's like the way that we do work has changed, but the politics have not.
Which I think is an actual bit of conspiracy, real life conspiracy, that the people in the like office middle managers who are in power in every office are like preserving their jobs by keeping office culture the same, even though, you know, communication is faster and you don't like need to be in an office anymore, but they're like stuck keeping the office the way it always has been.
Otherwise their jobs are irrelevant.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, and then they'll have to get real jobs.
I also love that, you know, one interesting thing about Initech, it's supposed to be some like, you know, tech company, and it's right before that generation where tech companies wanted to be cool. And we have ping pong tables and massage tables and a cafeteria. It's almost the pendulum swung the complete opposite direction, where we want to make the office space fun and inviting. You never want to leave. Of course, subtext is you never leave, because now you're like,
never can leave. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. We lock it from the outside. But it is quite intriguing, because by the time I got into the workforce, my friends who did go to places like Google and Facebook, they had these experiences where you had laundry service and massages, and in the middle of the day, they're taking naps. And it is almost kind of a dated reference to watch this, because this looks like it could be any nondescript office, whereas I think tech companies would pride themselves that, oh no, we're the antithesis of office space.
Mm-hmm. Which may or may not have been a reaction to the movie itself, right? The movie itself may have changed the trajectory of like how specifically tech companies market themselves to their employees.
Sure.
Let's talk about our scene, the scene in question.
Scene in question. As the song kicks off, Peter's parking in his boss, Bill Lumberg, played by Gary Cole, in his meme-making performance parking spot. Peter's wearing casual clothes, a big no-no in the 90s corporate world. And so Peter wanders into the office. He approaches the office door handle that always zaps him with an electric shock and just removes it with a drill. He pulls down a motivational banner in the office. He's seen going fishing with his roommate, Lawrence, and new girlfriend, Jennifer Aniston. And he sits at his desk, pulls a fish out, slaps it on his desk, just guts the fish. And all the juices and stuff just go over what are probably TPS reports.
I remember this scene from the trailer of the movie. Like, I have a vivid memory of this scene.
And the most, I think, now possibly polarizing little moment is, and because I think that we now think about cubicles a little differently. It's like we've gone through a whole journey as a society with how we think about cubicles. But in this scene, Peter drills open one of the walls of his cubicle space and just knocks it down so he can see out the window. And I just want to quickly comment that when I started in like corporate office spaces, I like sometimes had a cubicle, but I mostly didn't because I started working in the 2010s when cubicles, open plan offices were seen as this like liberation and anyone could just walk up to anyone and ask them a question. And then the downside being, of course, that you can't concentrate. And if you put your headphones on to try to concentrate or at least show that you're closed, like my mother used to say, I'm closed to me and my sister when we were bugging her or when she was working, then you're seen as like being antisocial somehow and non-approachable. And that might hurt your office mojo or whatever. Now, if you're in the office, people are kind of wanting that personal space back. But at the time in 98, cubicles were seen as these like matrixy or just
prison.
A cog in a machine or just you're a little house made of ticky tacky. There's nothing special about you. And so Peter is expressing his just newfound ease of life and just no fucks left to give under hypnosis and wants to look out the window into the parking lot. And so I thought that, and I really didn't realize this before researching it, but the song that we're here to talk about, Damn It Feels Good, is kind of lightly satirical in and of itself. And we'll talk about Ghetto Boys a little bit more down the line. But the song is basically describing kind of like the power and the pitfalls of being at the top. If you're in a gang, and the tension kind of lends itself to Office Space's plot as Peter, he's got this new fuck it attitude to his work life, which does result in him getting a promotion. But at the same time, he gets a little too cocky and he's like, with his friends, we're going to skim off the top until something goes wrong. And then it nearly results in he and his friends possibly being arrested and going to prison.
To
and I just wanted to highlight like the last verse in the song, which is so relevant to the whole idea is like gangsterdom could be out in the open. It's not just like hidden or in like a city or like a neighborhood. Gangsterdom could be at the very top of the political food chain. So here, just check this out. I'm not going to rap it. I'm just going to read
it. Oh, no. The dramatic reading. Cue the masterpiece theater music.
Damn, it feels good to be a gangsta. Getting voted into the White House. Everything looking good to the people of the world, with the mafia family as my boss. So every now and then I owe a favor getting down, like letting a big drug shipment through and send them to the poor communities so we can bust you-know-who. So voters of the world keep supporting me, and I promise to take you very far. Other leaders better not upset me, or I'll send a million troops to die at war. To all you Republicans that helped me win, I sincerely like to thank you. because now I got the world swinging from my nuts, and damn, it feels good to be a gangster. That is from 1992.
Wow. Donald Trump should have used that in his like election campaign, right? That seems really apt.
It reminds me of the coup's Fat Cats and Bigger Fish, which is like has a similar kind of last verse of everyone's hustling, the political leaders just hustle a little bit better and on a bigger scale.
Yeah, and that's the thing, even with Office Space, right? So these three guys get so much sort of mental anguish thinking about going to prison and what are they doing? It's unethical, but who knows what Inatech is doing on a corporate level. And then again, we can go all the way to the White House and beyond. Who's skimming who? Who's sort of gaming who? It takes a very sort of a fun satirical comedy and can turn it into something very sort of nihilistic and depressing.
And this was in the 10-year period where we weren't at war in the last like 50 years. Mm. And so like had this come out in, let's say, 2002, we definitely would have been at a like they're making software for missiles and drones and all this other stuff that was used to make war.
Yeah,
totally. Yeah. Well, I find really interesting. So that Geta Boys record came out on this compilation in 92. So this movie came out in 99. Let's assume they decided the movie in like 98. So when we take a step back and remember what was going on in hip hop in 98, it was a very different sound, very different aesthetic. We're very much at the height of like the bling era. So it's like Puffy and Mace, Jay-Z, all of that sort of celebratory aesthetic in hip hop. And the fact that they went sort of into the vault, into what's arguably an older song, it was never some huge hit, I think is interesting. I mean, some part of it might have just been it's cheaper to license, right? A song that wasn't a huge hit. And who knows what kind of deals they were doing for Sinks back then. But it is quite interesting that this was the record that they chose, not something of that time period.
Yeah, that's an angle that I really didn't consider either. And I agree that they probably saved a little money in that respect. But I had a lot of fun learning about just like the political background of Geta Boys and how they were part, I mean, we'll talk about this a little bit later, but they were very much part of their like music's entire history of like having a tension with like these morality police. And Geta Boys had some very politicized, they had some very polarizing lyrics and a kind of a fraught history of getting like tossed around like a hot potato between like record labels and people who would work with them and put out their music. For this episode, as we tend to do, I feel like every episode we do, we find a ring or oral history from which to pull some fun facts. And I was pleased to see that there was some really good insight into how the scene came together on the Ringer for the oral history done by friend of the pod, Jake Kring Schreifels.
Hey, Jake.
Hey, Jake. So Mike Judge, according to this oral history, he starts out by talking about how when he first heard this song, he thought, well, this should be in the movie. I love the feel of it. It was a mellow vibe. That it kind of matches Peter's newfound mellow under hypnosis, and Mike Judge was like, "This feels like a release." And Willie D, so Jake got Willie D, who he's like kind of the go to for any Geta Boys interviews. Like he's around. He does a lot of interviews about the band, and I think he's gotten into politics a little bit as well. Really smart, well-spoken guy from what some interviews I've read with him. And he said, we actually did an Office Space Geta Boys tour in 2015. we had some office furniture on the stage, and part of it was having a printer, and we smashed the printer with a bat. So we reenacted the scene. So he's talking about the scene soundtracked by Still when the three of them take the printer / copy machine out into the field and just smash the living hell out of it.
When was this tour? This sounds amazing. I would go to this tour right now.
This was about 8 years ago, and maybe almost now. It was in 2015.
It's like a combination of a tour plus, like, what are those called? The breaking rooms where you go break stuff?
Yeah, the break rooms. Called? The rage rooms.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Yeah. Oh my God, the rage room.
Tour. That'd be so fun.
Oh, my God. Have either of you ever done that?
No,
I want to so bad.
I did see there is a band called, oh, man. I think they're called Family Force 5. Mm-hmm. I saw them play when I was working at the House of Blues in Boston, and one of their members, their only job was to kick over an aluminum chair on stage, and then one of their other members would run in from off stage, set the aluminum chair back up, and then the first guy would kick the chair over again. That was the whole thing. So I guess that
I really want to know how much how the money was split in that band, because I have some questions.
Probably not evenly.
Yeah.
That's likely quite a story.
Did they mention in that oral history how, like, you know, that conversation, how they got together or anything about how much they paid for the sing?
Good question. Not that I saw. I would need to go back, honestly, and look at the whole thing. Like, I really zeroed in on the moment itself. That's a good question. No, I mean, I think this is kind of the most time that they spent on it. But Willie D is talking about how, like kind of the way the song mirrors the moment and how Peter is taking the path of least resistance. And Willie D says there's two times in a person's life they can experience something like that. One, when you're basically having a moment and you feel like a gangster. The other is when someone has pushed you to the brink and you're like, God damn it, I want some respect.
Wow. I also love the fact that when Peter, the less he does, he gets promoted in this company, which I think of us have seen in the wild, right? The guy, usually it's a guy.
The white man failing up.
I really don't want to be here. I do nothing. And, you know, and instead of firing him, the consultants are like, wow, that is management material.
Genius.
He just gets promoted. And for all the kids out there who haven't been in an office, it's not a meritocracy. And the Peters of the world are very common, where it truly is sometimes coming in and saying, I don't want to do this anymore. Like, you know what? You got a moxie, kid. We got to promote you immediately.
Mm-hmm. As a white man, I can't wait to fail upward.
You just got to listen to more Ghetto Boys. And if you have the Peter attitude,
you need to go work in an office.
But there is something to be said, you know, the times, because in various times in my life, I have been in office settings. And there is something to be said about the people who put their head down. They do the work. They're the workhorse. They don't get promoted, right?
They just get more work.
They're
too indispensable.
They just get more work. I've been, that's me. Like, that's who I feel like.
She's got TPS reports after this podcast that she's got to fill out.
I feel like that was my rude awakening in office life, because I spent the first 2 years of my work life after college gigging in the gig economy because I couldn't find a full-time job.
Sure, yeah.
And when I got a full-time job, finally, I got promoted kind of, but it was only a name. There was no pay bump. It was I was like, hey, millennial, you understand the internet. So we're going to give you an internety job title. But then as I moved through the ranks and entered different workforces, and like, I've been at big companies and small companies. I've been freelance. I've been full time. I've been contract. And you learn in those corporate settings that, because I always kind of thought of myself as the workhorse. And then I saw like people who really, really didn't deserve that pay bump or promotion. And like the one time that I was promoted for like meritocracy, then like the whole team got fired like in the next 3 weeks.
They're like, well, Rachel got promoted, so all of you got to leave. You could thank Rachel, though.
Bye.
It was my fault, yes.
But not to like lambast the boomers or anything, but this is a very like I can speak for myself. This is the work advice that I was brought up with, is like, work hard, make yourself indispensable, like work yourself to death so that they know how good you are and they'll want to keep you, they'll want to give you more money, which like that those two things aren't connected necessarily. Like
they'll want to give you more tasks.
Because I came up in the music business, right? So my first like music industry internship was Bad Boy. So that's Puff's label. And it really was, you come in before your boss, you don't leave till they leave. And that might be midnight, it might be 1 a.m. And that was the mentality. I would say even through, this was like into the aughts, but I would even say like into the aughts. But I remember once I graduated, I moved to New York. This was after the music business had been decimated by file sharing and iTunes. And a lot of that paradigm shifted because the people who used to be in power weren't in power no more. So now you come into a new space and it truly was working smart. Of course, work hard, like show what you have. But I learned very quickly in my, you know, first couple industry jobs, I started the William Morris Endeavor in the mailroom program, like the famous talent agency. And your dream was to get from mailroom to assistant. Now I know that that was my dream. Okay. So it was a long time ago. We all had dreams back then. And it was crazy because even when I was pushing that mail cart at 21, 22, I looked around like, wait a minute, some of these assistants are like almost 40. What is going on? Really? And that, but that was the game. And everyone came from very high Ivy League schools, top state schools. We had MBAs, we had lawyers, but it was like this old school Hollywood mentality of the only way you're going to learn is by being somebody's assistant. Now, I came with that kind of millennial mentality of like, nah, I can't do that. And I ended up leaving in under 2 years and went to a startup where I made more money. I was working with the heads of every label. They gave me a BlackBerry business cards and said, get to work. But I think to myself, had I stayed in that, put your head down, do the work, and one day you'll be anointed, I would still probably be doing filing for, you know, honestly. And it's just so interesting, you know, how the paradigms constantly change and COVID just changed the whole game. Like I talk to some people now and they're like, I'm never going to an office. I don't care how much money you give me, how much, you know, high profile, like no way. But in the music business, a lot of the execs, they really want you back in the office. Like those days of working remote. And but it goes back to what Rachel, you were saying, like a lot of times people have to keep up sort of the protocol because that makes them important, right? Imagine if your job is to basically oversee employees. Well, your employees are remote. So why are you here? Right. So a lot of this sort of protocol and stuff is largely implemented just so people, you know, no one realizes that you're obsolete. You don't need to work here.
I know that my parents listen to this podcast. So I just want to say, like,
hey, mom and dad.
Hey, no, no hate whatsoever. But I do remember early in my career, I was like a job hopper. And I would change jobs like every 2 years. And I remember, and you know, my parents come from a different generation. And I remember them kind of being like, are you sure? What if you just put in
what
more
about
time?
Your pension?
And I was like, I'm never
going to. I'm actually shocked that you moved so much because even when I came up, there was this idea under a year, you're not doing anything. I don't care how miserable you are, you suck it up because there was like this. Almost like a fear. What will people say on your resume if you move
on your resume?
Yeah. I was aware. I was aware of that. And I, you know, I looked into it a lot, but there were, it was mainly like, okay. So in the very beginning of my career, it was kind of like a means to an end because I wanted to work in music or entertainment editorial, but the only job that I could find in the beginning was at a parenting magazine. And at that point I was like, well, I just want to be part of a team. I may have to give this up. I need like the protections or whatever, like the benefits of a full-time job. And I'm just going to do this because like, this is what I need in my life right now. But, I never really stopped looking because just that the dream persisted.
What was your dream? What was your dream job when you first graduated? Like, what would have been the golden ticket for you?
For me, like a staff music writer somewhere at some magazine, like the
but like
the
job, a specific one.
Yeah. So the job actually that I got in 2014 was like my dream job, and that was as an assistant editor at Spin. Like that.
Nice.
That was what I felt I had worked toward. But I had some advantages, but not all of the advantages. I did work with some people who'd gone to journalism school, and they'd met a lot more people, and they didn't have to kind of scrap for as long as I could, because I didn't really have that network when I graduated. Mm. So by the time I actually got there, I've been kind of like, I'd had one other kind of really high profile job at MTV writing about pop music. And it was good, but also I'd stopped sleeping. Like I just developed this horrible insomnia. And
were you at 1515?
I was at 1515.
Wow.
2 years.
What years?
2012 to 2014. And then Spin 2014
to 2016. MTV Hive and Rap Fest.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I was at Buzzworthy.
Nice. I did some great interviews at Hive, but they pulled them all down. So when I tell people, I interviewed Travis Scott, I interviewed whomever, like they're like, really? I was like, I'm sorry, you can't find it. It's in my heart.
Yeah,
I promise
all of my, because like they really, not to get off topic, but like they kept their archives up forever. You could find articles from like 2002. And now they've done some kind of like clean. I don't really need to see any blogs about me writing about Justin Bieber's gym selfies. Or I think the worst one I ever wrote was like Nicki Minaj's camel toe. I had to write a whole blog about that. But my dream job, like it did arrive in 2014, and then in 2016.
Was it everything that you thought it was going to be? Like, was the dream realized?
In some ways, it was. Because the people I was working with, they had really high standards for how Spin should be. Because, like, they were very hyper-aware. Shout out to my former editors, Kyle McGovern and Andrew Unterberger. They really, like, whipped my writing into shape. Because I really didn't have any editors prior. Like, I had editors, but I was... there was never any time to really like hone the art. And that was the first job that I kind of felt like I was really honing. The only real issues I had, to be honest with you, Somia, is that Spin Media, they kept kind of repackaging the way the office was looking. There was never any like permanence about like who was sitting where, because the Spin Media owned Us and Vibe and Stereo Gum and gosh, like the Frisky and like a whole other bunch of sites that are all they've since been bought and sold off, and Spin included. And so for a while, the Spin staff was working in this like WeWork, but nowhere even near as nice as a WeWork. They stuck us in this place called Grind, where we all had to sit in like a conference room table, like smelling each other's farts, like basically being driven insane by the physical proximity of having to work that. Like we didn't have our own desks, and that was really hard. I think just like being that physically close together and not having like a typical like, my desk is here and your desk is there. But
the funny part is, so now that's become more the norm. So I did some work for a tech company, and post COVID, everyone has a hot desk. So you literally don't have a desk anymore. It's first come, first serve, unless I guess maybe your friend reserves your desk if they get there first. And I just wonder for employees, what is that psychological effect? So Office Space showed that a cubicle was kind of like a cell. It was like a prison. And I understand that. But what does it mean when you don't have a space? And every day you go to an office, you're sitting somewhere different. You can't put
your
pictures.
You're like even more disposable.
Yeah, that's what I think.
Yeah. You just want like a little... I mean, for me, I know I need like a little, not downtime, but I need like that decompression time where I just don't talk to anyone for a minute, and those walls help.
Not on the clock, Rachel.
Well, I'm still working. Clock. I'm still working.
You got
time to lean.
You got time to clean.
Mm-hmm. I just don't want to talk to anyone. There's a difference.
We're all a family here, Rachel.
Oh, wow. We're all
don't
a family.
Even,
yeah.
Don't even and, get and, me started.
If your boss ever says that, just go on monster.com, update your resume, and plan your exit immediately. Yeah, run.
I've had two office jobs. One of them was remote during COVID, and one of them was like a dozen years ago. And I have been two Ron Livingstons in my life. In Boston before I left, I worked at a home healthcare company, like logging nursing visits for people who are homebound. And I would get my entire week's worth of work done by Monday afternoon. And then just sit at my desk and listen to podcasts from Tuesday until Thursday. I would take 2-hour lunches and ride my bike home and take naps and come back. And that was a pretty okay job, actually. It was very boring, but pretty okay. And during COVID, I was working at a startup where I was producing some podcasting content. And because it's a startup, they're constantly relaunching their app, relaunching their website. And one weekend, the project manager, who's also a job title, which doesn't mean anything or do anything, was guilting people into working through the weekend because we were relaunching the website, which happened every 2 months. And someone was like, oh, I have a plan. I'm logging off at 5 p.m. on Friday. And she just straight faced via Zoom was like, oh, are you not planning on chipping in like the rest of us? Mm. And I was like, I fucking hate this place. I got to go.
Wow.
Did you actually quit?
I did not quit. I was laid off.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Okay.
We've all been there.
Hey, same end result, right? Yeah, it's interesting, though, because I do think the flip of all this, right? Of course, we sort of see the negative sides of being the office, but I do think there are a lot of positive attributes that in this time I think people do miss. I mean, I know when I was in my early 20s, all of my friends I met through work, the people you date, you meet either at your office or, okay, now we're all going out
through coworkers. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, they say even now, most people meet their romantic partner through work. If everybody's working remote, I mean, unless you're hot on that Zoom and, DMing everybody the chats, it's tough. Like, I mean, even for me as a journalist, I really try to do a lot of my interviews in person. So for my book, a good chunk of them I had to do remote. But one of my favorite interviews, I got to interview Cam, and I'm a huge Cam'ron fan, and that was in person. And it was right before he was getting on the stage to do Verses. It was at a jewelry store out in New York in the Diamond District. And it was just such a much better interview than on Zoom. And that's the one part, right, that I do wonder, what is the balance moving forward? Because even in office space, two of his best friends are his colleagues. So what does that mean when that sort of environment is taken away? I don't know. I think we're going to see a little bit of loneliness and isolation in adults, maybe more than we've already seen. So I just wonder, what is that balance, right?
I'm definitely not against in-person work. I'm a teacher and I really prefer teaching in person to teaching online. But I think everything that comes, the people, the folks that are railing against having to return to the office, I totally identify with too, because it's there are things like the commute, the office politics, all this stuff that could also be solved with a good public transit system, with a good with less toxic work environments. So working in person doesn't necessarily have to be in a tech. Though one way to escape working or try to escape working at an Inatech is to work remotely. Didn't really work.
Yeah. I agree. It depends too on your stage of life, because I know for me, when I was starting out, all I wanted was an in-person job because it seemed that was the norm. What I was doing was outside of the norm, and I felt really lonely. And then I had 10 years worth of in-person jobs, got sick of the politics. And then after COVID started and we all went remote, I just never went back. And
same, yeah.
And I was like, well, maybe some, you know, for the right thing, I would. But ideally, like, I've already had that experience of working around people and within those political bubbles and spaces. But a lot of people just, they haven't had that yet if they're much, much younger. And I agree. It will be interesting to see how it plays out and what that, what the new quote norm becomes.
Totally.
I want to learn about the Ghetto Boys.
We'll talk a little bit about the Ghetto Boys. Now, they, as I mentioned up top, the Ghetto Boys are one of the more controversial hardcore rap groups to come out of their time. I think today they would be less so, considering the doors that they opened for others. I'm thinking primarily of Eminem and all the flack he used to get for his lyrics, which were about 10 years after Ghetto Boys came out. Wow. But when they came out of Houston. They were a trio. They were signed to Rap-A-Lot Records, an indie. And they were three entirely different rappers, Jukebox, Raheem, and Sir Rap-A-Lot. The group fell apart after their first single in 1986 called Car Freaks. And after they kind of disbanded, Rap-A-Lot owner and producer James Smith reformed them in 1988, this time with rappers Willie D, Scarface, and Bushwick Bill.
You're telling me that the Ghetto Boys are scabs?
It sounds like the idea is just exists independent of whoever.
No, that means the company. The company owns the Ghetto Boys, and
yeah.
You could be swapped out, like, you know, a project manager. Yeah,
like Menudo.
Mm-hmm. It happens all the time with like girl bands. The Spice Girls had one member swapped out for Emma Bunton and
Destiny's Child. Like, yeah, it's common. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So let's see. By 1990, the boys were finally ready to release their major label debut on Rick Rubin's Def American via Geffen. But Geffen balked at the album's graphic lyrics, which did involve necrophilia, among other things. So at the time, this is why I love New York Times writer John Pirelli's, because he has been there for so long that and like talked to people from like 40 years back his career, like, and still manages to write really observant pieces about like Taylor Swift. But I digress. So at the time, the New York Times is John Pirelli is, he quoted a Geffen spokesperson and kind of got the explanation for why Ghetto Boys were dropped. And this piece said, "While it's not imperative that lyrical expressions of even our own Geffen artists reflect the personal values of Geffen Records, the extent to which the Ghetto Boys' album glamorizes and possibly endorses violence, racism, and misogyny compels us to encourage Def American to select a distributor with a greater affinity for this musical expression." And Bushwick Bill at the time told John Pirelli's, "We were just expressing stuff that happens in the ghetto, just being like reporters. We want to make everybody mad enough to look at the ghetto right in their own state, not just to look at the middle class and the rich areas. There are people who curse worse than me and want to hide it all, but I ain't no hypocrite."
Who's the rapper that called hip hop hood CNN? I don't know.
I don't know.
Yeah. But that's like just something that's always stuck with me, is like that rap is the way that news and gossip and storytelling travels through certain, you know, neighborhoods and socioeconomic.
I think it was Chuck D, by the way.
I believe that. Sounds like Chuck D.
That sounds right, right?
Yeah.
So a month after Geffen's rejection, Ghetto Boys, they were picked up by another major distributor, Warner Elektra Atlantic Records. And but still, the record did have issues being stocked at some record stores due to the controversial content of its lyrics. It is, however, I think, important to note that popular music has always been subject to moral scrutiny. So I think the most recent example of this is the ongoing RICO case against Young Thug and YSL Records, where a judge recently ruled that Young Thug's lyrics could be used in court against him and other alleged rap gang members in an upcoming criminal trial. And in this type of moral panic has existed pretty much as far back as like the 1930s.
I have so much to say about this. It's like, this makes me furious because like you're not putting Ted Nugent in jail for singing about Sweet 16 or whatever, even though he like adopted a woman so he could marry her. I don't know. I feel like there's like a huge racial component to what is and what isn't allowed admissible in a court of law based on like the crimes that you've committed.
Yeah. Makes me furious. There are historical moments that pop up all over the place with this, like Pete Seeger being suspected of communism and indicted for contempt of Congress when they pulled him into court in the 50s, and Elvis obviously sexually awakening teenagers in the 50s, and heavy metal and in the 80s. And
yeah, what was it? Was Under the Knife was the Twisted Sister song?
Yeah, and the whole and hip hop got pulled into this kind of controversial or whatever like morality abyss as well, and that started in the 80s and like bled into the 90s.
Yeah, so, remember Tipper Gore and the
exactly
parental Darling advisory stickers. Yeah.
Yep, exactly.
All because she didn't want her daughter masturbating with a magazine.
Anyway, so that's kind of the backdrop that we're looking at. Not that there isn't an argument to be made of misogyny in hip-hop lyrics. That is also a thing. I have never personally felt like I am, you know, the right journalist to really dig into that discussion. Maybe, Soumya, if you have any, like, you know, if you have any input there, you are obviously, please, we welcome it in terms of its Ghetto Boys' lyrics.
Well, I mean, I think when it comes to lyrical content, again, for the most part, separating the art from the artist is a kind of the long-standing conversation. I think when it comes to like misogyny specifically, it's that much larger conversation of how women are treated in society. Right? Music is merely one lens, and these are like young men speaking through their experiences. But let's be honest, from politics to just our social culture wars, like women really have a lot of ground to cover for us to truly gain equality, right? So it's kind of like a much bigger conversation than bitches and hoes, which is very easy for people to like minimize it into. You know, I think the Ghetto Boys were just like an interesting group. I mean, coming from the South, this is still a time when New York was the epicenter of hip hop and the West was still vying for that respect. Of course, we have Snoop Dogg and Pac and people like that, NWA, coming out of the West, but the South was still very much kind of this uncharted territory. And to this day, I oftentimes talk to people from New York who are not big fans of Southern rap, but they tip their hat to Scarface. I mean, Scarface is a great rapper, and he ended up doing a lot of work with East Coast artists like Jay-Z. At one point, there was talk he might even join Rockefeller. Like, he very much kind of transcended those regional boundaries. But it is interesting that his start was in this group that was sort of known as like horrorcore and sort of like this dark rap, and where his career ended up going after.
We're going to take a quick break, but first, I want to just set the stage a bit for how Fox president and like the powers that be at Fox, how they felt about the Ghetto Boys inclusion in Office Space. At first, they were not for it. So Fox president Tom Rothman apparently told Mike Judge that Ghetto Boys had to be taken out. And Judge said after production that he would take out Ghetto Boys if the next focus group also disliked it. But a guy in the focus group apparently said that the characters who worked in an office but also listened to gangster rap was one of the things he liked most about the movie. And that got Tom Rothman off of Mike Judge's back. And here we are.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll discuss Office Space's legacy in the American workplace and in American cinema, and how the Ghetto Boys almost got cut from the movie.
St. Clair's Health. My community, my hospital, my commitment.
My commitment is helping my cardiac rehab patients so they can live an active and fulfilling life.
My commitment is to my patients' comfort and their confidence in me with their diagnostic scans.
My commitment is to truly care for each of our emergency patients. I see them when they are most vulnerable.
St. Clair's Health, around the corner, ahead of the curve. St. Clair's Health, my community, my hospital, my commitment.
My commitment is to support my patients as they face their mental health challenges and help them achieve their goals.
My commitment is to give my patients the care they deserve and trust so they can get back to the life and family they love.
My commitment is to be by the sides of moms and their babies on their most memorable day.
St. Clair's Health, around the corner, ahead of the curve.
Okay, so Peter, Michael, and Samir's plan goes horribly right, and their computer bug accidentally steals hundreds of thousands of dollars over the weekend, so they definitely are going to get caught, until a last-minute saving grace, the bosses have taken away Milton's red swingline stapler, and he makes good on his threat to burn down the building. It wasn't until preparing for this episode that I noticed a pretty strong, albeit unintentional, connection to another male-centric 1999 cult film, Fight Club. Both movies are made by iconoclastic directors who got their start on MTV. Both of the main characters are floating through life, miserable at their jobs, and in desperate need of therapy, which it seems neither of them actually ever considers.
Except for hypnotherapist, I guess.
Except for hypnotherapy and support groups, right? Like therapy adjacent, but would never be caught dead in actual therapy.
Yeah.
The film deals with corporate America and what it means to be a man in the late 90s. Both characters become different people through these mental adjustments. The main characters take drastic measures to get out of their slumps, and those dramatic measures get out of control. And both films end with the main characters watching a building on fire. Robbie Blasser from Cine Nation agrees with me, but our conclusions of the lessons of the movie are considerably different. So I want to ask everyone, what was it about American masculinity in the late 90s that could have caused two satirical comedies? I will maintain that Fight Club is a satire until the day I die, to come out the same year. And let's add to that the reference that you made, Rachel, a little earlier to The Matrix, right? Mm. This cubicle farmed thing, prison that you need to escape from. What was it about the late 90s that made three movies come out in the same year where someone escapes a cubicle?
I mean, I think it kind of ties into a conversation that I've seen take place on the internet about how millennials won't have a midlife crisis because we don't have the dream. And it's like these prototypical men are white men are in seemingly stable jobs. They may not be with anyone or have a family. I think that this trope kind of also goes into like a movie like American Beauty, but they are so, I guess,
which also beige. Came out in 1999 mm-hmm. and also is about a guy escaping a cubicle.
I guess they're in such a beige place of the American dream, which is still ostensibly the American dream. I mean, if you climb the corporate ladder and blah, 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 then you'll be happy, except that they're not. They're, in fact, miserable because they're just being subsumed by, like, the minutiae of workplace life and just the gray that kind of bleeds out into day-to-day, like, outside of their life. I mean, you notice Peter's apartment is just like drab as hell.
As gray as the office, yeah.
So I think it's like partially a reaction to just this like, oh, now we're here. Now what the hell do we do? Oh, we're miserable. Except that, and it runs a bit counter to, I think, like our generation's experience because we're like, we'll never get everything. Yeah. What does having everything even look like? I don't know. Are we ever going to be able to have a house?
So let's look at it on a timeline, right? So we have the boomers, and we said that the baby boomers' idea is to work hard and you'll be rewarded, and that's the American dream of stability, right? And then we have the Gen Xers, who it seems like four different times in 1999 said, you can attain the American dream, and then you're basically dead, because there's no, there's nothing after that. You've crossed the finish line, and it's like this malaise or ennui that you feel when you achieve your American dream, and it is miserable and something that you need to escape from and in literally or figuratively blow up. And then we saw that, we millennials saw that. And as Somia, as you said, you like, we read this as a cautionary tale, and we're like, you couldn't catch me dead in an office. And so it is like this three-step process of dismantling of the like American, the dream of the American workforce accidentally. Yeah. And they all, so weirdly, all came to a head in 1999.
I mean, I also wonder if there's some symbolism in the year 1999. I mean, I remember Y2K. Yeah. Like, was there this idea of you've done all this work for what? Now, of course, we now know nothing happened on January 1st, 2000. It was business as usual. But I wonder, and I mean, I wasn't in the workforce at that time.
I'm still reporting from my bunker.
right. You're still waiting, you know, watching TRL to see what the news update's going to be on January 1st, 2000.
Tin cans
or like astronaut ice cream or whatever. But I think it's that too. It's just, imagine the people who grew up kind of that MTV generation. They lived through grunge. They saw, you know, the first dot-com wave, so maybe they knew people who got really rich being a part of companies like Netscape or AOL
for no goddamn reason.
Yeah, just because they happened to be right place, right time. And now some of them are, you know, about to hit 30, which back then, 30 years old was like, you better be married, 2.5 kids, minivan, living in the burbs. So I think a lot of that kind of came to a head, I can imagine. And I think for millennials, on the older side, I think some of us still grew up very much idolizing the brands. So again, speaking about the music business, like, we dreamt about working at Def Jam and Bad Boy. Like, that meant something to us, is to put that corporation across your back and work really hard for them. But as time went on, you started to see that shift where people were like, wait a minute, why am I building your brand when I could build my own brand? And everyone started focusing on seeing themselves as CEO, seeing themselves as a boss. And the whole mentality shifted, where the things that our parents viewed, whether it be home ownership, having kids, owning a car, not that important. You know, we can lease cars forever and it's fine. Or instead of a down payment, we want to fly business class, or we want to, you know, take vacations.
Kids, just because we don't want kids. Yeah.
Exactly. And I think we just came from a very different definition, you know? But I do think an office space in 2023, one could argue and make a very interesting version, because I think a lot of these feelings of success and growing up and alienation and all of those are still universal. I think you could make a really compelling 2023 version of it.
They just look different. But your point of like the 1999,
there's a lot
of it all.
Botox now, not as many lines as they had in a tick.
Lip filler.
Yeah, a lot more duck lips.
The 1999 of it all is super interesting, because it is, it's the end of times. And it's also like, we're coming off of like a historically prosperous decade for America, where it's like,
thanks Bill Clinton,
the 80s, but kind of miserable, where, like, you know, we're realizing that without cocaine, the office is like not that fun.
It really isn't.
And so I think that it's so strange how like the monoculture had something very specific to say about the American workforce in 1999, and we just like didn't listen. We were just like, what's that? And then before we knew it, 9/11 happened, and all of our movies were about patriotism.
Yeah. But it's also funny that all of the protagonists in the movies you mentioned are white men, because in American society, they're supposed to be the leaders and things work out for them.
Yeah.
yeah, they're the head of the household. They're the winners. So if they feel this ennui, oh, it's fucked up for everybody else. Like they didn't even bother to look at, you know, what a woman was going through, what maybe somebody who was like gay was going, no, we're going to focus like, if Brad Pitt is feeling this way, there's no hope for the rest of y'all.
So Office Space was weirdly the little movie that couldn't. So Mike Judge of Beavis and Butthead fame had a series of short cartoons for SNL of a character named Milton, who was an office dude who hated his life and was just going to lose it one day. And Milton was voiced by That Guy Hall of Famer, Stephen Root, who was in News Radio, Get Out, Barry. He also plays Milton in the movie. He's a chameleon of stage and screen. And the inspiration for the film came from a temp job that Mike had that involved alphabetizing purchase orders. And those are like the TPS reports. And another job as an engineer at Parallax Graphics for 3 months in the Bay Area during the 80s, just as the heart, like just as Silicon Valley was starting. And quote, just in the heart of Silicon Valley and in the middle of that overachiever yuppie thing, it was just awful. And the character of Milton was based on one of Mike Judge's coworkers who threatened to quit if they moved his desk one more time. So 20th Century Fox wants a Milton movie, which I don't know, man. And neither did Mike Judge. Judge told Peter Chernin of 20th Century Fox, you don't want to know what this guy does when he leaves work. So they instead
gets really dark.
It gets fucking dark. And that's basically what our jump to conclusions guy is like, a version of that, where he like tries to kill himself in the garage by inhaling carbon monoxide. But they one of the Fox execs was like, oh, like that Richard Pryor movie Car Wash, but in an office. And Mike Judge is like, yeah, fine. But there were a ton of issues during filming, specifically the heat. Texas, I don't know if you know this, is fucking hot. So by the third day of shooting, temperatures were over 100 degrees and there was smoke from fires in Mexico that filled the sky over Austin. Once again, not that close. And so they had to, the traffic jam scene that opens the movie, they had to postpone that until the fires cleared. And studio, speaking of Rachel, you mentioned how like drab and beige everything is.
Yep.
That was on purpose and the studio did not like it. They were really unhappy with the dailies that they were seeing. And Mike Judge quoted a studio executive as stating, you need more energy, more energy. We got to reshoot it. You're failing. You're failing. And they also asked for Ron Livingston to smile more. Classic.
None of this would work. Like, ugh, ugh. Okay.
But they did not like
I think
how
they wanted to be of that time, right? Because it's funny that we're talking about the era. I've watched this movie so many times. I could have sworn it was shot in the early 90s. Like when I found out it was 99, it bugged me out. Like, wait, let's go back to 99. This is Britney Spears and NSYNC, TRL. It's about bubblegum and pop and bling and fun. Mm-hmm. This movie has none of that aesthetic. And I can see where the head of a studio is like, wait a minute. Like we want it to look, you know, a little bit more like youthful and fun. And this just looks drab and it could have been shot at any moment in time. But I think that's also why it stands now, because you watch it and it could be from last week or from two decades ago. And it feels very much of the now.
Yeah, it's a testament, actually, because like it's such a watchable movie and yet it's the dullest. It looks awful.
It looks terrible. It's everybody so just washed out and like sad.
Yeah.
That is so true that it could be from whenever that Office Space served as some of the visual inspiration for the Ben Stiller Apple TV Plus show Severance.
Oh, I was actually going to ask if there was any connective tissue there.
Just like some visual inspiration. Yeah. But I think that show is one of the greatest shows ever made and looks beautiful and gray. And beautiful and gray.
I would even throw in The American Office too. Like 100%. I remember, you know, the actors talking about when they came to read an audition, the casting director said, don't wear makeup. You need to look like you work at a failing paper supply company in Scranton. Don't look like Hollywood version of regular. You need to look like a real person in America. And from the clothing choices to like the cars they drive, just everything, it fits within that lens. And if you watch that, it's a very drab show.
Yeah.
Especially in the first couple seasons.
And
Office Space limped so that The Office, the American Office, could fly.
Yeah.
And I do mean limped. Like this was not a successful movie, but in addition to like wanting
did it even
more,
make back its money? Like when you count we'll talk about DVD?
Yes. So
you
with
mentioned
the home
something
video
about
market,
Comedy
yes.
Central. With Comedy Central yes. has a big role in Office in Space's cult classic status.
So, but it, back to like the idea of wanting bubblegum pop and wanting it to feel very late 90s style. Fox did not like the gangster rap used in the film at all. So, Rachel,
yeah.
why don't you tell us about some of the sinks that would have been?
Well, apparently they were trying to get Chumbawamba.
Fuck yeah.
So Tom Rothman apparently said, you've got to get rid of the gangster rap. I want the movie to be fun. I think Chumbawamba is fun. And then he said, I've got this wrong. Mike Judge is recalling that he said back to Tom Rothman, I think that it is fun. And Tom said, it's too dark and angry. And he just kept insisting. So Mike Judge is talking about how he's recounting the focus group story. And he says at the test screening, they have 20 people afterwards. They were like 18 to 25 year olds. And this woman who's the moderator is asking a bunch of questions. And then she gets to the point. She makes a sneering face and she goes, well, what did you guys think of the music? Kind of like, ew, wasn't that bad? And all 20 of the focus group members go, oh, the music was great. And so she's like, okay, but what about the gangster rap? And she's just trying so hard to get one negative comment and the focus group wouldn't give her anything. And so Mike is remembering maybe there was just too much of it. Like this focus group lady is just trying to eke out some negative comment. And this kid who is 19 says, no, but that's what's so great about it. There are these geeky white boys in cubicles and the music is angry because they're angry. And wow. That's it.
But the wildest part about this is Chumbawamba are communists. They took all of the money that they made from licensing that song Tub Thumping to Chevy and donated it to the Chevy workers union. Like they're like legit communists. And so their inclusion in this would have been very close to like the message of the movie, the kind of the anti-capitalist message of the movie, but I Get Knocked Down and I Get Up Again is nowhere near where Peter's mental state is as he's gutting that fish on his desk.
No, he gets knocked down and he just sort of lays down. He gets comfortable.
He wasn't even knocked down. He knocked himself down.
I get knocked down and then I get comfortable. So the movie's done. And the studio releases the now infamous poster of Ron Livingston, covered in Post-it notes, which doesn't have anything to do with the movie. And Mike Judge hated the poster that the studio created for Office Space. He said people were like, what's this? A big bird? A mummy? A beekeeper? And the tagline was, work sucks. So it looked like an Office Depot ad. And Mike Judge just hated it. He hated the trailers and the TV ads especially, which I like very viscerally recall the fish scene and the cubicle scene, the cubicle wall dropping in the TV ads. But this was like the era of like stunt advertising for movies. Blair Witch Project had just come out. So they're like, fuck yeah, let's do something weird. So the studio had a man live in a plexiglass cube above Times Square for 5 days, and it was live streamed on the internet as he answered calls and emails from people who hated their jobs. And Ron Livingston visited the cube for like a press event, and none of the reporters cared to talk to him. They were more interested in talking to the man in the cube.
That's like put some performance art shit.
It is. And like this was like around the time where like David Blaine was like living in a block of ice and like yeah. doing weird shit. But this coupled with like the bad test audiences for the movie told Ron Livingston, like, it was a foregone conclusion that the movie wasn't going to open well. And so the studio dumped it in February, which famously was like, no one goes to see movies in February. And it opened really wide. It opened in 1,740 theaters, but it only grossed $4.2 million on its opening weekend, which is bad. Very, very, very bad. So the studio pulled it from theaters after only like 3 or 4 weeks. And then, in a turn that could never happen today, the film had a huge second life on home video and on TV, which is where I saw it.
Me too.
It made $12 million total at the international box office. And as of 2006, made just as much on home video and TV.
Wow.
So it had a $10 million budget. So the general Hollywood wisdom is you have to make twice your budget to be considered successful because of the print and advertising money that the studio has to put in. So finally cracking $20 million is the sign of success. And it did it around 2006 from the home video market. Comedy Central premiered Office Space in August of 2001. And that single airing drew 1.4 million viewers.
Because they're all at home after work watching TV.
Exactly. But in the next 2 years, the channel broadcast it 35 more times, which seems actually kind of low for the number of times I watched it on Comedy Central.
I remember we got the VHS tape.
Oh, you did?
And then because my dad loved it. He was always quoting Milton. Yeah. And so I think it was just watching Comedy Central, like somehow we ended up with the VHS and just watched.
Milton's my man.
Yeah.
But these Comedy Central broadcasts helped develop the cult following, and Ron Livingston credits the regular airings on Comedy Central for making Office Space like making him famous in that cult. Quote, I felt like it kind of went viral before that concept existed. But success comes in many forms. In April of 2002, Swingline brought Milton's Red Stapler to market, which didn't exist at the time of the movie's release.
Yeah.
The art department had to make it. And finally, like 3 years after the movie came out, Swingline finally released it to the public.
It's like Milton's one hope. And you were talking about how beige the movie is, and that pop of red,
the red,
is like Milton's reason for going in and not setting the office on fire.
Aren't Swingline like the Rolls Royce of staplers? Like they're gold, right?
Yeah, they're
like those staplers. Yeah,
like that. You're the funny girl.
You're him.
Yeah. Also, I remember. I mean, for my Sex and the City fans, Ron Livingston famously played Jack Berger. And funny enough, he broke up with Carrie on a post-it note. So there's a full circle.
Oh,
yeah. But I know. So as we get into the late 90s, early aughts, I wonder if there were people who drew that line. Like, wait a minute, that's the guy who did Carrie Bradshaw dirty.
I was also surprised that he was in, he was in Band of Brothers, right?
He was, yeah.
And I didn't see Band of Brothers till years later, but at the time, this is all like late 90s, early 2000s work, I was surprised, like, wait, Band of Brothers, that's so different, because I feel like the role of Jack Berger was kind of like an alternate dimensional version of Peter Gibbons.
Yeah, very much. It's like if Peter was an author who got dropped by his publisher, he would be this guy. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I know Ron Livingston from yet another source, which is his role as Ron in Swingers.
He's
Jon Favreau's friend who is considering taking a part as Goofy in the Disney park. And that's another just Peter Gibbons-esque role, but as an actor. So Ron Livingston has been like the guy in the background of all of our childhood favorites.
Yeah, for sure.
4 years after the film's release, Mike Judge is working on the script for Idiocracy with Eitan Cohen. And they went to a Starbucks in Austin to grab some coffee between writing sessions. And Mike Judge overheard two baristas doing a Bill Lumberg impression.
Yeah.
Eitan Cohen was like, are you saying that just because Mike Judge is here? And they're like, oh, have you seen the movie? And this is when Judge realized that the movie had a much cultural, was much more culturally relevant than it was financially successful. Also that same year, Mike remembers that one of his assistant directors on Office Space told him that they had, that he had gone out to eat at a TGI Fridays and noticed that the wait staff was no longer wearing buttons on their uniform, the flair that Joanna quits her job over in the film. And they asked the manager why. And the manager told them that Office Space had come out and customers started making jokes about their flair. And so the entire TGI Fridays chain dropped the requirement from their dress code. So wow. Mike Judge tells Deadline Hollywood, maybe I made the world a better place.
Or at least a less falsely happy place. Yeah.
Little less flair. And the printer scene remains the film's most memorable. It has been frequently parodied online. And just before the 10-year cast reunion screening in Austin in 2009, a printer was destroyed outside the theater by the actors that were in the scene.
That's funny.
They like got a new printer out and banged it out. And Turnabout is fair play. During the Republican campaign for the campaign for the Republican nomination in the 2016 presidential election, sentient blobfish Ted Cruz, who claims to be from Texas, but we all know that he's from the devil's anus, ran a political advertisement. No problem. Going off script. He ran an advertisement parodying the scene showing a Hillary Clinton impersonator and two assistants destroying the her personal email server with a bat in an open field, which is like, come on, man. The fuck are you doing?
It's funny when Republicans try to be funny.
It is like a dog walking on his hind legs. You're like, good for you.
No, that's more.
Good try.
Yeah, there's really nothing. It's just like you think that's funny. Like there's no self-awareness.
Also, what does an email server look like? Is it just like a little box?
Who
like
can
a little
say?
Wi-Fi
it's just
box?
A box. What does that even that's mean? Correct.
It's whatever. It's whatever they decide for it to look like.
I also wonder, like, moving forward, does that joke feel dated? Because how many of us are really printing stuff or faxing? Like, is that one of those old tech alerts? You know what I mean? Where it's like, oh, we don't do that. It's all DocuSign.
I think it is. But I think the idea that they're smashing it somehow makes it a little bit more evergreen than if they were, like, somehow getting it to work, like if it was the Cadillac of printers or something.
Totally, yeah.
But ultimately, the movie, the subject matter, and the movie itself are a relic of the 90s. Fewer people are working full-time office jobs today than ever before. It's only 13% of the American workforce.
Wow.
Which is insanely low. I couldn't get the numbers for 1999, but it is down at least 3% every decade. So it's probably like down from like 25 or 30%.
Next 4-day work week.
Hell yeah, dude.
I mean, my question
dream
is
a little bigger, 2-day work week.
Yeah. You talked about that the original has doubled its budget, so it's now considered a financial success. How long before somebody tries to do the reboot? Like, or the musical based upon the movie, based upon, you know what I mean? Like, you know, Hollywood loves that IP. So how long before this turns into something else in 2023 and beyond?
And this is a great point because movies don't get made this way anymore. Today, it's unheard of having a home video release equal to a box office release. It hasn't happened in like at least 15 years. And so now we are mining old IP. We have Mean Girls, the movie, the musical, the movie.
Not your mother's Mean Girls.
Not your mother's Mean Girls. Okay, dude. It came out 20 years ago.
I felt offended with that catch line.
Yeah.
I don't know.
How old do they I think after
we watched the movie, they presumed we all had kids. And now we're grandmothers.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
instantaneously like spawned another teenager. But I think that is where we're at. And Mike Judge has resisted doing crazy spinoffs and sequels to many of his properties, Beavis and Butthead aside, and King of the Hill aside. But I think that they're, you know, that is the way to see Office Space again, is to see the Mike Judge executive produced reboot limited series on HBO where no one's getting their proper residuals, and where it is a all remote office space, office cyberspace.
I can see that.
It's going to be super cheap to produce.
Sponsored by Zoom. Honestly, great.
I was anti this until I started pitching it, and I'm like, you know what? I'd write that script.
Yeah, but it's not the worst idea you've had today.
That's true. Although those are the ideas that I've said out loud.
Yeah, Sinking the Ghetto Boys might be a little more expensive now.
But who would today's Ghetto Boys be? Is it like Run the Jewels? I'm thinking of like political rap.
Right,
yeah.
Right. I don't think that's a bad guess. Yeah.
I think they'd be too expensive though. Remember, we don't have that much money for this project. Zoom is paying for half of it, and then Hewlett Packard's paying for the rest.
Honestly, what am I thinking? It's not even going to be a new artist. It's going to be some TikTok famous, Instagram famous drill rapper doing a horrible cover of Damn It Feels Good to Be a Gangster.
It's like Lil Pump doing that, his version of it. Yeah. And just different enough that we didn't have to pay the original. Yeah.
Timothy Chalamet's character.
I was just about to suggest that. You read my mind. Before we're getting close to the end, but before we wrap, I wanted to open up to the room. What would each of you do with $1 million adjusted for inflation?
I did the adjustment, by the way.
I saw. It's like almost double.
$1.85 million.
Now, wait, are you adjusting for New York taxes, too? Because 1.8 out here ain't that much.
No. You're on your own. Texas taxes.
All right. Okay. Now we can play.
So almost nothing.
Now we can play. You know what's so funny? Even 1.8, and maybe this just shows where we are, it's not like life-changing money.
Not that much.
It is a down payment on a house.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I probably like put down payment, you know, go on a few vacations, take my family on vacation, maybe get a Birkin and call it a day. And then go back to work on Monday. Like, it's not like crazy, like retirement money, which also shows where we are as a society. Right.
I wonder if it was retirement money in the movie, right? Because Dietrich Bader's character is like, whatever the fuck I want.
Do you remember the movie Blank Check in the 90s?
Do I?
How like $1 million was enough to like buy a dream house and just pour money out of your butt forever.
Okay, so here's something that I have to say about Blank. I have so way more to say about Blank Check than anyone would ever want to.
Okay.
First, that was in 1993, so we have to do the inflation calculation again. Second, there's an extremely famous screenwriting book called Save the Cat. Every young screenwriter reads the book Save the Cat. It is their Bible. And Save the Cat is written by a guy named Blake Snyder. And Blake Snyder wrote exactly one screenplay that was produced in his entire career. And it was the screenplay for Blank Check.
Wow. Okay.
That's awesome.
Wild.
I mean, even now, I remember getting into the workforce and my dream was to make six figures. Like, that was the dream. Oh, my God.
And now you can just barely survive on six figures.
I mean, six figures in New York is you still better get a job at Inatech on the side because that's the level, you know what I mean? So also it's interesting before you get into the workforce, what you deem to be like success.
Yeah.
Like even a million. I mean, it's great. It's a blessing. I'd take that 1.8 now if you want to Venmo it to me, but that's not retirement. That's all right. Like you're comfortable for a little bit, have some fun, save a little, invest a little, but you're still going to work.
Yeah,
pay off your student loans.
Yeah,
just like get into the black.
Yeah, right.
You know,
get out of debt.
That's what you do. Just get out of the red and into the black, and just like resume your daily life.
What would you do, Rachel, with your 1.8?
Honestly, what Somia said, that pretty much sums it up. Like, I would get a house and. Like with three bedrooms in LA. Yeah.
Well, fancy.
your 1.8 is gone. That's it.
Yeah. What are you going to do with the rest? Yeah.
I have nothing.
You got to come up with the other million.
I guess that's all I want.
And you're not getting three bedrooms. You still need a boarder now in room two and three. Yeah, so right, she's running an Airbnb. That's her new job. Airbnb.
I guess so. Yeah.
I want to be an Airbnb empress.
but it wouldn't even be like in one of the more desirable neighborhoods. It would be like in Glendale. Ooh. I'd get like a
shots fired on Glendale.
No hate to Glendale. I love Glendale.
No, I hate Glendale.
I will hate Glendale. On Glendale. I have friends and family who live in Glendale.
Some of my best friends are from Glendale.
I think, but truly, but realistically, it's a little bit more three bedroom affordable for 1.8. So like you have to like take what you can get, and then also like you know, do a little tradesies, right? So we live in
an Airbnb on the side.
I'm running an Airbnb. No, but probably not for much longer because Airbnb is. I'm running a Vrbo.
Vrbo.
What would you do, Aviv?
I gotta keep it classic. Two chicks at the same
time. 1.8. I mean, that's going to cost
1.8 chicks at the same time.
That's where you're going.
That's our episode for this week. Thank you so much, Somia. Where can people find more of your work? Where can people buy your book? Is there a place that you recommend other than the In a Tech of Our Times, Amazon?
I leave it open. If you want to go to Amazon, that works. Otherwise, Barnes & Noble or your favorite indie bookstore. The book is Fashion Killa, How Hip Hop Revolutionized High Fashion. Otherwise, you can find me on social media, not working, and the handle is SOWMYAK.
That's it for NSYNC for this week. We'll see you next time. We will be back next week. Thank you for coming back for season two. We're edited by Katie Yonner, production coordinator Kyle Bosch, associate producer Lou Barron. Hi, Lou. Social media producer Dale Stamfley, executive produced by Tommy West. Original music, not adapted music, by Taylor Barefoot. We are a pro Taylor podcast. NSYNC is a production of Gotham West Studios. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at the NSYNC Pod. And until next time. Damn, it feels good to be a gangster. The brother shank ya, but a brother like myself will kick back the peep game. Cause damn, it feels good to be a gangster.
St. Clair's Health, my community, my hospital, my commitment.
My commitment is to support my patients as they face their mental health challenges and help them achieve their goals.
My commitment is to give my patients the care they deserve and trust so they can get back to the life and family they love.
My commitment is to be by the sides of moms and their babies on their most memorable day.
St. Clair's Health, around the corner, ahead of the curve. St. Clair's Health, my community, my hospital, my commitment.
My commitment is to support my patients as they face their mental health challenges and help them achieve their goals.
My commitment is to give my patients the care they deserve and trust so they can get back to the life and family they love.
My commitment is to be by the sides of moms and their babies on their most memorable day.
St. Clair's Health, around the corner, ahead of the curve.